Back into the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN, and we have to talk to our guy on some college football. Week one's behind us. Week two is on the way. Colton Denning joins, owner of Two Stripes CPD. Make sure you go subscribe there. Also subscribe to his YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com/Colton Denning. Dubsco on X. Colt, what's happening, man? How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I had a lot to imbibe this week, so I feel like I'm still recovering. It's, what, Wednesday? So a couple more days to go until Saturday. So yeah. just trying to recover over here, brother.
I hear you. Still in recovery mode on a Wednesday. Got to love it. I have to ask you, how was the experience watching Colorado-Georgia Tech last Friday?
That goes back to the imbibing conversation. There's not a lot from the game that I remember just being there, so I had to go back and watch it and check it out. But it was awesome, man. Going to Folsom Field's always – it's one of the best places in college football. That's the first time I'd been there since 2019. And the game itself was one of the more exciting of the week. You know, you start with three turnovers from Georgia Tech, so you can't capitalize. We can get into that. But comes down to the final few minutes, and Georgia Tech shows – what type of brand of football they play rushing for 320 yards. But I had an awesome time there. It's always phenomenal at Folsom Field.
Yeah, but Colorado, what do you think about the new era, right? Post-Shador, post-Travis. I know it starts with a seven-point loss. You don't want to start in the loss column. But it's still competitive. It's not nice, you know, looking at that first half where they had a plus-three turnover margin and we're still down going into half, so you could view that how you want to view it. But what did you think of the competitiveness of the team and the talent that they have on that team post really what was a golden era of the 2020s?
I loved it in certain ways, especially running the ball. I mean, they ran 31 times for 146 yards, 4.7 per carry, and for the average, you know, fan of any team who's able to run the ball, you might look at that and be like, okay, that's just, you know, whatever. But for Colorado, even predating the Deion Sanders era, there hasn't been a lot of times recently where
we got to date it back to Chris Brown.
Yeah, it's been ugly, man. Philip Lindsay. But outside of that, there hasn't been a ton, even in the later stages of the Carl Durrell era. But, of course, in the first couple of years of prime, it was just throw, throw, throw. And I think they have something with this offensive line, and they have a nice little stable of backs with Michael Welch, Simeon Price, and DeKalen Taylor, who I think showed out really well and is going to get more run as the season goes on and against Delaware this weekend. So just being able to run the ball a little bit more, and I think Caden Salter looked tentative at times, whether sure. He wanted to throw or run. I thought there were times where he could have, on the first touchdown even, picked up a first down, but he made a nice throw to Taylor for the opening touchdown. But there were a couple of other times where it's just like, it was the same conversation with Shador, funnily enough, where you're like, man, just take the 5 yards. So I think as the season goes on, we'll see a little bit more of that. But just running the ball, I like what I see. And then defensively, in the run game, it can't get much worse. So I think they can only go up from here.
Yeah, but Georgia Tech, you know, they pose some problems. They've posed some problems since Haynes King took over there. They run the hell out of the ball. That's just what they do. And that offensive line has been very good as well. But I don't like, you know, doing the coach blaming thing, being the Monday morning quarterback type guy, but the Pat Shurmur play calling, especially in that first half, really almost all the way into the third quarter bothered me to a certain extent. Caden Salter, I know he is very good with his legs. Like, that's what he does probably best. But he's a guy who's been in college for 5 years. He's a guy who's played a lot of ball at Liberty. It felt like he could have dropped him back a little bit more. No, like that was one of my big issues. And I ended up tweeting this out, especially, you know, in that first half. It felt like he was trying to treat him like the Denard Robinson at Michigan. Just read option after read option after read option and trying to see what he could do with his legs.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think you have to do that now with the quality of backs they have compared to the last couple of seasons. So hopefully that's just a feel thing, and if it's just a game one of, okay, now I know exactly what we have in a live game situation, I would hope that changes a little bit. And I think you can look at coaching overall for Colorado. Even in Prime's first two seasons, game management has been an issue. And despite how much I drank during the game, I distinctly remember on that last drive
right.
being like, Why? I can't say the words I used there when I was in the stands, but I was like, why are we not calling the timeout here? So to leave that game with two timeouts in your pocket is it's tough. And it's not like you're losing to a bad team. Georgia Tech is a very good team. Hell, they may be even a team when you look at their schedule that, you know, you look and it's, I think, Georgia and maybe somebody else left on it. They can beat a lot of teams in the ACC and even maybe compete to get one of those outer playoff spots. So there's no shame in losing to a team like Georgia Tech. But you're going to look back at that one and I think going to see you improve over the course of the season and say, man, it was just little things. It was these coaching things where it could have been different if we had been there. But you know what? It goes down in the loss column, and you just have to get better from there.
Yeah, it astounded me. It took so long to drop back Caden Salter, give him some, you know, more passing concepts, get him into a rhythm. Because at the beginning of the fourth quarter, I'm sure you remember the drive to tie the game up. He went 6-for-7, 59 yards, and had a scramble into the end zone. It was just like, where was that the entire game? But to your point, I think this is all on Colorado's shoulders, all on Prime's shoulders, Caden Salter to a certain extent, because the end of that game, awful, awful management. And like, it was compounded. I thought Deion played it horribly. Take a timeout, handle some business on the sideline, dial up a play that you feel comfortable with, get vertical, see what you can do. But also, Caden Salter, I was very surprised to see him waste that much time being as experienced as a quarterback as he is. He stood back there in the pocket, ran around, tried to make some plays with his legs on that final drive, and took, 25 seconds off the clock over a two-play period.
It was too cute overall, and that's, I think, the best thing for them if they're going to take an honest look in the mirror at themselves is, to your point, it isn't just Caden Salter. It wasn't just Pat Shurmur. It wasn't just Prime. It wasn't just the run defense. It was everybody. So you can either point fingers at everybody or you can use that as a point to say, okay, it's on all of us and we need to all improve from here because we can't just look at one thing and say, hey, it's your fault that we lost the game. That was a team loss from them, and so hopefully they can use that and starting with Delaware this weekend and some Juju Lewis coming in, highly touted freshman quarterback. They can move on from there. So I'm optimistic. If they would have just gotten blown out of the water, then obviously I think we're looking at this a different way. But this was a game that they could have won. I don't know if you'd say they should have won, but it was right there for the taking, and now you move forward from it.
And by the way, a strange ploy by Coach Prime this week, just sort of saying, oh, Juju's going to play. Obviously the five-star that they ended up recruiting, he's a freshman. But he says he's going to play. He didn't necessarily say he was going to start. So I wonder what that's going to look like. It's going to be interesting to watch, no doubt. All right, now getting to the big matchup of the week, Texas-Ohio State. Ohio State wins 14-7. And I think all of our eyes sort of shifted in this matchup to Arch Manning with all the expectations. He was the shortest odds favorite to win Heisman. Texas, shortest odds, favorite to win the national title. But talk to me about Arch. He finishes the game 17 for 30, 170 yards, one touchdown, one interception. It was just I hate to put it this way, and I sort of saw it coming, and I think both of us saw it coming because of the type of place the shoe is and the amount the fans get involved and Arch Manning in his first year starting. It was always going to be tough for him, but that was a dud. When we look at the offseason and preseason expectations versus what actually happened on the field, an absolute dud for Arch Manning, no doubt.
Yeah, and I think what really kind of cemented it was just how many – it wasn't just like, okay, this is a freshman coming in making his first start. I think a lot of the hype was, okay, we've seen him for a couple of years in spots here and there, so at least he has that experience and he's going into it this not being his first game, essentially like what Julian Sayens is. And so he's going into the shoe with a little bit of experience, but some of the throws, I mean, just dirt balls, stuff that, you know, if you don't expect him to look like the best player in the country, you certainly expect him to be able to execute stuff that Sark was dialing up. And maybe that's a deeper conversation because I think Sarkisian kind of didn't put him in the best position to succeed either. I think, again, it wasn't just Manning. It was both of them. It was the offense as a whole. But there were maybe two throws, and they were the two throws late where I thought, okay, this is a pretty damn good quarterback. But outside of that, there was nothing impressive at all. And it doesn't have to be, oh, he's going to suck for the rest of the season. But you can't look at that and say, this is the guy that everybody was saying, hey, he's going to win the Heisman. Look, the Browns GM and the ownership are there scouting the game at Ohio State. Very obviously, they're looking at Arch Manning. You're looking at Cody Kessler right there. So I think that maybe that's the best thing for him going forward is to just throw up a dud. The expectations lower completely. Texas isn't going to get killed for losing by 7 in the Shoe, and then they can just use that to lower everything, lower the heat, lower the volume, and kind of make things easier for him. I don't know. Maybe that's cope.
No, but that's the thing that you mentioned it off the top of that answer there. That's the thing that just really bothered me is the misses. Obviously, the famous one is on third and short. You have a drag route to Ryan Wingo that he probably could have taken for 6. I mean, truthfully, if you just put it right on his numbers, he's going to make something happen. Ryan Wingo is too good of a player. But certainly, you at least convert that third down. But that was a miss. And then I just go to watching off the top of that game. Second play of the game, they have a flood concept. And that's the dirt ball I think you were talking about. About 10 yards short of his wide receiver. And it felt like his mechanics were off, although I'm no mechanic expert when it comes to throwing the football. It just felt like he was, I don't know, the Ohio State crowd or the moment being too big, it seemed to get to him. And I felt like there was a lot of people that thought that wouldn't happen because of his last name.
You know what, too? I would love if we could give some truth serum to Ryan Day and Matt Patricia and say, hey, what did you guys see on film all off season? What did you think about this player? Because the one aspect of this game that I don't think people are necessarily talking about, just because it's been all about Arch and his performance, is how Ryan Day managed the game. That felt to me, without the special teams aspect, very Tressel-esque, where he just said to the offense, hey, we're going to grind it out. They really didn't do anything that exotic. You know, they threw to Jeremiah Smith, I think, 7 or 8 times. He had a couple of drops, but they didn't go out of their way to get him involved down the field. It felt like they kept things really simple, and maybe that's because they saw Manning, they saw that offense, and they said, hey, if we just turn this guy over a couple of times, we score a couple of touchdowns, control field position, we're going to walk out of this with a win. We don't need to overcomplicate this.
Yeah, all right. Now, another game, the probably most surprising result. I didn't think that this was possible. Florida State wins 31-17. Alabama couldn't run the ball after their first game, the first drive, quite frankly. They went right down the field running the ball. Ty Simpson looked good. But then after that, Florida State locked in and really won in the trenches against Alabama. And that was so surprising to me, considering I looked at their depth chart going into the week. I know what Alabama's offensive line is and the type of talent they have up front. And I saw that Florida State's too deep on the D-line, only had one guy over 300 pounds. I didn't think that boded well for them, but hey, they handled business. Alabama under Kalen DeBoer. How concerned are you with where this is headed? This is 3 of the last 4 games have been dropped by him. He has 4 unranked losses. It took, in 14 games, by the way, it took Saban 235 attempts to have 4 unranked losses. Where are you at on the Kalen DeBoer sort of panic scale at Alabama?
It has to be something. It's not. I wrote about it in the hot seat rankings this week, and I put him at number 10 because he's not going to lose his job. We know that. Unless he pulls a Nick Saban in 2007 and actually loses to Louisiana Monroe like Nick did this week, then I think he's okay. But I thought what you brought up at the top there was great about that first drive, because they used basically 9 minutes of clock. They go 17 plays, 85 yards on that opening touchdown drive, and you think, okay, Kalen DeBoer's version of Alabama, this physical version of Bama, is here. Florida State took over barely 3 minutes to respond with a touchdown of their own. And then the game was just kind of, it wasn't over, but Florida State just completely controlled it after that. And I think that's the most concerning thing, is when you watch these games and you look at these top-level teams and their ability to take a punch. It didn't look like Alabama was able to take a punch. And what everybody's talking about now is, when's the last time We saw that, and it was really pre-Nick Saban, and now there's so much noise. You hear former players like A.J. McCarron coming out talking about NIL or saying that Ryan Williams is soft and can't run routes. And so the noise has just compounded on itself, and I think if you were Kalen DeBoer, it doesn't matter how safe your job is in this moment. When you have all of that noise, it's absolutely a thing. And so even a game like this for Alabama, their first drive, if they don't come out and score a touchdown or get a three and out or get an easy stop against UL Monroe, it's going to be like, well, these guys have just kind of quit. So now at this point, it's just managing the noise. And so that's what I'm really fascinated to see about with Alabama now is they took that punch against Florida State. They couldn't get up. How are they going to do that for the rest of the season?
Yeah, and they missed the college football playoff last year. A lot of complaining from the SEC because of that. And, complaining about the strength of schedule metric, even though they lost to a bad Oklahoma team and a bad Vandy team. But that's beside the point. They have one loss on their schedule already. First SEC games at Georgia. Then Tennessee looked pretty good. They're going to obviously have a third Saturday in October. They're going to play Tennessee. They have at South Carolina. They're going to have LSU, who looked really good in week one, beating Clemson. It does look, if you're losing that game the way you did, it does look like another year where Alabama's going to be on the outside looking in at the 12-team playoff. Right now, obviously things could change. They could convince me along the way. It's happened before. But if you're losing that game in that fashion, I don't have a lot of hope that you're going to be able to turn it around and be a national title contender at this moment.
We can only judge these teams based off of what we've seen, right?
Sure.
Off of one game. So off of what we've seen, no, not at all. When you have to travel to Georgia, when you have to play Tennessee, you got to travel to South Carolina, LSU, even an Oklahoma team you lost to last year. And then there's always voodoo in the Iron Bowl when it's at Jordan-Hare Stadium. So I don't know how you can look at Alabama and say, okay, yeah, they can come back from this. Just based off of what we've seen, maybe that'll change. And look, you play football. You would know better than me. Is it bad when your team's having a players-only meeting after week
That's
one?
That's bad. That's bad, yes. Not good. usually the kiss of death, to be honest with you. That's bad.
Yeah, and so you look, and you know what? They play UL Monroe this week. They play Wisconsin at home, which I think is going to be fascinating. I don't know if Wisconsin can beat them, given how Wisconsin looked against Miami of Ohio and the injury to quarterback Billy Edwards. But you have two coaches. Wisconsin definitely much lower on the noise scale, but you know Wisconsin didn't look great. If they go in and beat Alabama or Alabama struggles against them, there's just going to be a lot of chatter between those two guys. So that's a matchup a couple weeks from now that I'm really fascinated with.
All right, now a big picture college football conversation that showed up repeatedly in week one. And I know we're in the age of analytics, and I know you and I are guys who, you know, we wish that we would throw it back a little bit. You know what I mean? Take points when you can, run the ball when you can. Like, we're throwback guys in that particular sense. But what I saw in the Ohio State game, Texas did it twice. They get down to the Ohio State 1, try the tush push, they get stuffed. They get down to the Ohio State 9, they get stuffed on 4th and 3. Alabama in that second half against Florida State turned the ball over on downs twice before the final drive that they turned the ball over on downs, and then the game was over. Do you think that coaches need to take it upon themselves to take points more in college football? I know we're in the age of analytics, and what you look at is, oh, you have a 60% chance if you convert this fourth down to win the game, as opposed to if you just take the three, you have a 45% chance of winning the game. But do you think that coaches need to get a little bit more of a throwback mentality when it comes to, let's just put points on the board when we can?
It certainly depends on the situation, but this was something that was my main takeaway of the weekend I wrote about it. For these big-time games, I absolutely think that's an area that coaches need to go back
sure.
and consider when it comes versus feel, versus analytics or whatever. You look at all these games now, and it really does feel like the big-time mid-2000s SEC top-rated on CBS slugfest is coming back into play. Whether, you know, you look at the top three games this week, Ohio State, Texas, very thin margins, very low scoring. LSU, Clemson, very low scoring for what, you know, you would anticipate with
17-10,
those quarterbacks.
I mean,
very defensive too, and just hard hitting. And then even Notre Dame, Miami, I know it ends 27-24, but there were a lot of plays in that game that were on the margin as well. And I think in these big time matchups, you probably do need to see more coaches just saying, hey, you know what, if we have a good kicker or a kicker we can trust, or a special teams we can trust, let's either play field position or let's just get points because we can trust our defense, we can trust the flow of the game. Yep. The team we're playing against also isn't 2009 Oregon, where they want to go up-tempo, high-octane, score 40 points. A lot of these games, especially with this new clock dating back to last year, it feels like these possessions are at a premium. And like Texas, when you get stopped on that fourth down, both times, one time they were at whatever it was, the 35 earlier in the game, you just kind of feel like you throw these possessions away. And in a 7-10-point game, you just can't afford to do that.
Yeah, and the mentality switch. That's what one of my biggest sort of, if I could go back and change that Texas-Ohio State game, if you settle for three in those two sort of red zone situations, I know Sark was not going to do that when they got stuffed, and you hit two field goals. 14-13 at the end of the game with about 4 minutes to go, of course, when Ryan Wingo and Arch couldn't hook up on that third down. Imagine the difference in mentality and play calling when you're playing for three to win the game as opposed to seven to tie the game. Like that changes the complexion of that entire situation. And I think it's a lot more likely Texas gets down there, Arch leads them on a drive for a field goal to win the game 16-14 if you did settle earlier in the fourth quarter for a field goal. Right? Like, it's just a mentality switch that it doesn't have a whole lot of foresight to just continuously go for it in those situations.
Yeah, and it kind of felt like Texas was getting to that point on that last drive, too, where they dialed up those couple of deep shots. Arch made two really nice throws. And if you were within 3 points there, you do have a change of mentality, especially for a play caller like Sark and with a young quarterback who you just say, all right, man, now we can go win the game, and you don't have to score a touchdown. We don't have to go 70 yards or whatever it was, 60 yards down the field and get seven. We just got to get it in range for our kicker, and we walk out of here with a win. We didn't play our best, but you just went in your first start in a big game like this, and you didn't play well, but you led the team to a win. And what we've kind of talked about all offseason with all these new quarterbacks in this era now, where we look at the last four national championship winning quarterbacks, you don't need to be the guy who throws it 40 times a game and is the 6'4" rocket arm NFL guy. You need to manage the game for your team.
Yeah. Now, final thing on week one before I get to this Michigan and Oklahoma game, Chapel Bill returns 48-14. TCU beats North Carolina in Bill Belichick's opening college game. And then you had a balloon arch in the press room. I said this yesterday, and I truly believe it. I just feel like this experiment is over before it started. Now, I Bill Belichick, he's got his legacy. What he did with Tom Brady and the Patriots can never be taken away. He's one of the best coaches we've seen at the NFL level. But this whole college thing, it just does not feel like it has any upside. I hate to say it.
I hate to bring this up again, but it's just too prescient in the storylines, it being against TCU and Colorado being against TCU a couple of years ago. It's extremely funny that the greatest coach in NFL history jumped down to the college level and actually became the sideshow stain on the university in the game that people wanted Deion to be, who were rooting against it. Like, this was the game that people wanted CU to have a couple of years ago, and that's exactly what North Carolina did. They came out on that first drive, and you thought, okay, well, they came out to play. Gio Lopez, the quarterback, was fired up. He was smacking his helmet every play, and you thought, okay, now we get to see the Bill Belichick and Steve Belichick college defense, and Sonny Dykes in that offense, and even their defense just said, absolutely no way. And it just felt like, you know what, they never after that were in the game. And North Carolina shouldn't feel like that. And I know that they completely gutted that roster, so you can't be like, oh, Mack Brown left them nothing. This one isn't on him. These are all Bill Belichick and Michael Lombardi and all that little brotherhood. Yeah. All of what they want to do, their brand of football, that's what it looked like. And I don't think it'll look like that every week, but for a first impression – that's about as bad as it gets.
Yes, and then you have him talking to his fiance, 24-year-old fiance, on the sideline. That was caught on camera. And again, that balloon arch in the press room. There's only one person that could have made that decision, and I feel like it's the same woman I was just talking about, but that's beside the point. Also, sort of sidebar, you brought up that opening script from Gio Lopez and how good it looked for North Carolina off the top of the game. We have a lot of opening script gods in college football at the offensive coordinator positions right now, don't we? Because once you get into that sort
that's what Alabama Florida State game was.
Yeah, exactly. You get into that sort of free flowing. Hey, let's call plays as they come to us. A lot of guys tend to sort of struggle and shrink in those moments. But that opening script that they've been working on for the past 3 weeks tends to work pretty well off the top of the game.
Yeah, that's why it's never – I remember the first time I distinctly remembered not falling for that or recognizing it was a thing. It was whatever that Sugar Bowl was between Alabama and Georgia. I think it was the last game that Bob Stoops coached it at Oklahoma. And Alabama just went right down in like seven plays, just looked like the best team of all time. And everybody thought, oh, this game is over. And Oklahoma actually ended up beating them pretty good. And ever since then, you kind of think, okay, let me not overreact a little bit to the whatever happens in the first drive. But now more than ever, and maybe it's just because we can watch all these games now, it really sure does feel like we're seeing teams and offensive coordinators just be able to prepare stuff, whether it's week one, like you said, for a month or in between weeks, and just dial it up and cook it up, and it's right there. But as the game goes on, players get a little tired. You can't just go into that bag. You got to have – players got to be able to make plays. You can't just be the mad genius. And so it's very interesting to see how these games play out, where a team and an offense looks so unbelievable on drive one. And then for the rest of the game, you're kind of thinking to yourself, like, what was that?
Yeah, exactly. I remember
what's happening?
I remember that Florida State team last year, week zero against Georgia Tech, the eventual 2-10 Florida State team. First drive of the game, DJU and that offense take it directly down the field and score. And I don't know if I saw that the rest of the season. You know what I mean? Like, you just, I think that's something people have to, if they haven't already gotten used to, get used to opening script football. Don't ever judge a big game or a game in general off what it looks like once the first offense comes out, because it usually looks a whole lot better than it ultimately will. All right, now week two, we have one top 25 matchup. It's a far cry from what we saw week one, where we had three top 10 and multiple just good games all over the schedule. But we have Michigan and Oklahoma. Michigan is going to visit Oklahoma. Michigan, though, week one, I know it's against New Mexico, and I know it wasn't some unbelievable, massive output from their offense. But Michigan's freshman quarterback, Bryce Underwood, 21 for 31, 251, one touchdown, zero interceptions. They ran the ball well. Justice Haynes coming over from Alabama, 16 carries, 159 yards. He had three TDs in this game. This Michigan team, they were hot to end the season last year with the win over Ohio State, then Alabama, and it feels like they finally have an offense that has a pulse, even though it's a true freshman and we can expect some mistakes. What were your first impressions of that Michigan team and Bryce Underwood in particular?
I think the main one is just that they've already opened things up for him. And I think that's what you have to be most encouraged about if you're a Michigan fan. Yeah, New Mexico is one of the worst teams in the country. But you can look at it and say, okay, right from play one, from drive one, this is his offense. They have at least enough trust in him from day one to be able to do that. And, you know, the opponent isn't the most impressive.
Sure.
But I think you'll see more of the same against Oklahoma. Whether it's as successful is going to be a different story, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I think that from all the talk I've heard and then seeing him week one, it's clear that they're extremely comfortable with him running that offense. And at the very least, they are going to be much more dynamic than they've been in the past few years. And we've seen them be able to use that kind of slugfest style of football and win with it. But when you have a talent like that and a quarterback like that who's already so young, as the season goes on, he's going to get more experience, he's going to get better, he's going to get even more comfortable in that offense. I think you can kind of throw away who the opponent was and just say, okay, them handing him the keys and being that comfortable already shows kind of where he's at and where he's going to go.
As we sit here on Wednesday, how do you feel about that game? right? Oklahoma 5.5-point favorites. John Mateer looked good. I know it was against Illinois State, but I think way over 350 yards, 3 touchdowns passing. He did have a pick, but he looked pretty good as well.
I think you got two teams and especially two offenses with something to prove because, yeah, it was against Illinois State, right? Like, I was scrubbing through the highlights of that, and I don't know what to really make of Oklahoma either. So this is one of those games where, you know, maybe either one of these teams surprises and they're, you know, pushing towards the playoff here in a couple of months. Maybe it'd be less surprising for Michigan. But this is a measuring stick game I really like because it's not an LSU-Clemson. It's not an Ohio State-Texas where the outcome happens and then whoever loses, it's like, oh, it's fine. They'll be in the playoff. When whoever loses this game, you're going to say, okay, we're going to take a step back depending on how they lose it. And it's going to be a little bit more. We're going to be able to dissect it a little bit more because the talk isn't just going to be, hey, well, at least they're going to make the playoff. OU losing at home to Michigan, you know, you're already going to sound the alarms for Brent Venables after last year, especially if their offense doesn't look great. And Michigan, you know, it'll be if they lose, they go in, freshman quarterback, you lose at Oklahoma. That's not the end of the world, but it also would temper expectations for Underwood and that offense.
For sure. Well, before I let you roll, Colt, plug some of your work with Two Stripes for my listeners. They need to go subscribe today.
Yes, they do. I had the week one takeaways a couple days ago. About an hour and a half ago, I dropped my weekly hot seat rankings, first of the year. We didn't get a chance to talk about it, but Brent Pry, buddy, you are on the hottest seat in the country as of right now. So each week I got the hot seat rankings, top 10 coaches. That drops around Wednesdays every week. And then as soon as we're getting off this phone call, I'm putting together the first hits of the week video. So I'll be upstairs just grinding away on Premiere Pro, putting those video clips together. So tomorrow on YouTube.com/ColtonDenning and on TwoStripesCPD.com, you can find hits of the week. But, yeah, subscribe. Go to the link. It's either $7 a month or $50 a year. I feel like it's the best deal in college football. Gabe loves it. I think you love it too.
It is. It's phenomenal work. But Colt, great stuff as always. We'll talk again next week.
I'm already fired up.
Yes, sir. He is Colton Denning at Dubsco on X. Make sure you go subscribe to Two Stripes CPD and also to his YouTube channel, youtube.com/ColtonDenning. Now we need to go ahead and hop into the Blitz. I have a bone to pick with Major League Baseball's pitchers. And also, we had a retirement today, a retirement from pro basketball. Linsanity, the Linsanity run is over officially. We'll talk about it all next right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
Now, the biggest stories overloading the line, a bull rush of info. It's Gabe's Blitz on the Gabe Kuhn Show on 92.9 FM ESPN, Memphis' sports station.
All right, so we're going to do something different. I'm going to take the first one today because this is something that grinded my gears last night, to say the least. Your boy Rafi Devers pimped a home run against Kyle Freeland of the Colorado Rockies last night. And it was a high towering shot, close to the foul pole. Rafi Devers at first was seeing if it was going to stay fair. Once he saw it was going to stay fair, he took his time down the first baseline. Now, what happened was Kyle Freeland got mad, right? And it became a benches clearing shoving match. And I don't think this exact situation, like this particular situation, is why I'm bringing this up. But it occurred to me last night. Like my brain did something a little bit strange last night, as opposed to, you know, historically when this has happened. A pitcher's job, what's their job, Connor, right? To get guys out, right?
Correct.
That happens, I don't know, they do that 75 to 80% of the time. 75, sort of normal, 80% if you're a really good pitcher. A hitter's job is to get a hit, right? Much less a home run, which just does not happen as often as getting on base in general, a single, double, triple, whatever it is. Let's operate off a normal 250 batting average. That's 25% of the time they're getting a hit. Then you have to account for the fact that home runs make up 16% of hits, historically. So when you run the numbers, and listen, that happens roughly. Listen, I'm bad at math, so stick with me here. That happens roughly 4% of the time, a guy hitting a home run. And I realize it's more likely if Rafael Devers does it in the situation last night than a normal player, because he's a very damn good player. But isn't that still a massive differentiation
4% of the time to 80% of the time. 80% of the time, the pitcher gets their job done. 4% of the time, a batter hits a home run. I'm not saying that like guys need to go full Savannah banana ball with it when they're rounding the bases after a home run. But if they want to admire it, take time around the bases, bat flip, we have to stop vilifying that. And like usually you'll see like the old curmudgeon say, act like you've been there before. Why? It happens 4% of the time historically. You know what I mean? Like if you continue to complain about bat flips as a pitcher and guys pimping home runs, then I better not see so much as a fist pump when you get a guy out or strike a guy out. You do that much more often than them hitting a bomb off of you. I came to the realization last night, Connor. It's the dumbest beef in sports, pitchers versus pimping home runs. And it's not logical. It doesn't make logical sense. Is my brain doing the right things? Am I correct in my assessment here?
I don't mind guys showing out a little bit whenever they hit a bomb, as long as they're not saying anything directly to the pitcher.
Sure.
And that's Devers wasn't last night.
Kyle Freeland got butthurt because right. He's it took a while for Rafael Devers to realize it was going to be fair, and then he sort of loafed down the first baseline, took a while to round the base.
Yeah, he's always done that, though.
Yeah.
Devers has always done
that. It's rare. It really is rare to hit a bomb.
I think the best point that you made was batters, I do think that there is a certain point in which it can go a little bit far. Have a little bit respect for the game, respect for the pitcher.
Sure.
And you won the battle. I don't mind a little bit of a pimp, but don't take it too far. I don't think Devers took it too far. But you bring up a good point. If pitchers are allowed to celebrate, batters should also be allowed to celebrate.
They should be able to celebrate a little bit more.
I think it can be a little
right?
bit. I think it can be sometimes corny for batters
sure. To
pimp a home run in a moment in a blowout game or a moment that doesn't really matter. But if it's a big moment, absolutely go for it. It's,
right.
But I agree with your point of
if
a pitcher can scream and fist pump and do all this stuff after a strikeout, then let's relax a little bit about being upset with Rafael Devers, celebrating a home run. It is interesting, though. I'll also say, like, you're also the Rockies. Like, it's not that big of a deal. I don't know, man. Like, just relax.
Yeah,
relax.
People have been dancing on your grave the entire year.
Yes.
Okay, this shouldn't have been the straw that broke the camel's back last night, Rafael Devers pimping a little bit of a home run. And I don't even think he tried to. If you watch it back, he really was trying to see if it was going to stay fair, close to the foul pole, and then he saw it and he started to jog down the line. It really was not that egregious, but pitchers, I don't know, they have thin skin. I think they're some of the most thin-skinned players in all of sports, truthfully.
Well, it can also be, I wonder if it's been grinding to play for the Colorado Rockies.
Sure,
and it was just like, oh, come on, man. Like,
it truly was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Come on,
man.
You don't have to celebrate against us. We're the Rockies. Of course you're hitting a home run. just go round the bases. Just round the bases. I think that was what was bothersome about the entire thing was Devers wasn't looking at the pitch. He wasn't getting involved with them. He was looking at the home run. He was taking his time, maybe a little bit too much time, but just
let it go.
Let it go.
Let it go. It's something that historically happens 4% of the time. You get your guys out 80%, 75 to 80% of the time. I don't know. I just feel like batters should be within their rights to celebrate something that's ultimately relatively rare. It's relatively rare in the sport.
You know what's not rare? The Red Sox breaking my back September. What have I been saying all season? I fell in love with this team.
Yeah.
I absolutely love this team, but
Roman
I knew
Anthony.
Something was going to happen in September that was going to rip my heart out. They are rolling right now. They are clearly going to be a playoff team, hopefully, if they don't have some historic fall in these last 23 games or so. But of course, last night, the son that was promised, the reason the Devers
trade
ended up being okay for the most part. The Roman Empire has fallen. Caesar has been stabbed in the back once again.
Literally.
Roman Anthony Oblique could be out 4 to 6 weeks. I am absolutely devastated. When he hit that home run off of Paul Skenes last week, Oh, I almost cried. It was so beautiful. This team has been one of my favorite Red Sox teams in a very long time. Probably my favorite team since 2018. 2021, we always knew it was a pipe dream. But this team, God, man, I was falling in love with them. And, of course, and Roman Anthony out for 4 to 6 weeks. Maybe there's a miracle.
And I know, maybe I don't know if he was going to qualify, but I think if he played most of the remaining
he's
games,
gonna be in the running.
He was going to be able to qualify for AL Rookie of the Year. That's off the table completely.
Just devastating. A literal backbreaker. I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming.
I do feel sorry for you. But this realization for me came months ago with the
Cardinals.
Yeah, we it wasn't it. Through injury, though.
No,
it's just through
I think
sucking.
That we did
it's
a,
just through not investing in the actual product.
I think we did a blitz segment on the Cardinals a few months ago where you and I were like, we don't believe any of this right now. Like, they were like, how many games over 500?
It was right after the basketball season.
This makes no sense.
Right after the basketball season, they won 2 straight against the Cubs and were like really close to the top of the NL Central. And I think they were holding on to the last wild card spot. And since then, just been absolutely horrid. But I do feel, I feel for you. I feel for you. Even as a Red Sox fan. Don't really like the Red Sox, but you're my boy, so
thank you.
Hey, it is what it is. You still, still in a decent spot
it's
from a standing standpoint, but you're just losing out on Roman.
They should be able to sneak into the playoffs. Maybe he can come back for the playoffs. That would be great.
Yep.
As long as they have him for the playoffs, I'll be happy. But man, this team—it's been a fun team to root for. And here's what I will say: everybody that's been fun this season should be back long term. So. Even though this season may have gotten its back broken.
God, how many times? But listen, many times have we heard? I hate to say this, and I hate to like put this on you like this, but how many times have we heard that in Major League Baseball? The Orioles were a team that were supposed to stick around with all their young players.
That's Baltimore.
Yeah,
though.
I know. But the Braves? How about the Braves?
They won a World Series.
They won a World Series, but what's it been since then? And this year, just miserable. They're like 10 games under 500.
If this group wins a World Series, I'll be happy. That'll be my fifth in my lifetime.
Sure.
Most people don't see five World Series in one lifetime.
I get it. I'm just saying, like, you have these grand plans for guys that are going to be on your roster.
Well, why are you doing that? Why are you putting this evil on me?
And it just never quite, sometimes it doesn't quite live up to your expectations.
Most of them are already under contract. So
yeah.
That gives me hope.
Shout out to the Atlanta Braves.
Take that pessimism back to St. Louis.
Okay, we'll do.
Gabe, the legend himself, Jeremy Lin, has retired from basketball.
Q, I will remember you. Please, can we get some music in here? I mean, damn, it's tough. Now, I did learn that Jeremy Lin has been balling in Taiwan the last 2 years.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
I did not know.
Won a champion.
Honestly thought he already retired.
Yeah, true. Well, because he hasn't been in the NBA and no one will sign him in the NBA. But he's played for the New Taipei Kings and the Taiwan Professional Basketball League the past 2 seasons. He won MVP last year and won back-to-back titles. So he's still doing his Linsanity thing overseas. But, you know, Mike D'Antoni, circa 2012, is that about the time? I don't think we're going to remember that anytime or forget that anytime soon. The Linsanity run, outscoring Kobe on the way to 7 straight wins. Like, it took over the sport. It took over the national spotlight. Obviously, part of it's he's doing it for the Knicks.
Yeah, this was in 2012.
Part of it, he's this unassuming walk-on that went to Harvard as a walk-on, was an undrafted player into the NBA, and somehow found a role with one of the biggest brands in the league, and balled on a 7-game winning streak. Scored 20 in 6 of those 7 games. When they played the Lakers, he had 38 while Kobe had 34.
Wild. Outdueled Kobe.
That was one of just like the, like, we talk about one-hit wonders in like music in that realm, in that industry. Like, one of the best, probably the best one-hit wonder in the history of the National Basketball Association.
It is one of the most memorable runs of all time. There are people our age think of Jeremy Lin as a legend, and he always will be. One of the greatest basketball players I've ever seen for a 2-week period. Just absolutely insane. The 38-point game against the Lakers, the game winner in Toronto, which and he turned that arena into a home game. People were rooting for Jeremy Lin right. in Toronto, even though he was beating their own team. Averaged 22 points over that two-week span, 9 assists per game. Was unbelievably insane, clutch. Man. He was a bright spot in a dark season for the New York Knicks. I will never forget that Linsanity run. And every time on TikTok or social media, if a Jeremy Lin Linsanity run comes across my feed.
Oh, I watch its entirety. I don't skip a second.
I'm pausing the video. I'm going to go pour myself a glass of Old Dominic bourbon, light a candle, maybe a cigar, and enjoy it.
Phenomenal. It's just like some of it was just so unbelievably greasy and lucky. But obviously, for a 7-game stretch, you can't just chalk it all up to luck. You can't chalk it all up to luck.
My guy was a good player. My guy was hooping,
and there's no other way to put it. All right, now college football is here, and just as always in the South, we are excited, and we have anticipation for what we are going to see, where your team is going to end up by the time we get into December and January. There is simply no better place, though, to catch every single weekend of college football than Caesars Sportsbook inside Horseshoe Tunica. You walk in and the energy hits. They have wall-to-wall screens, 15 HD TVs to be exact, and they will tune it to whatever game you want. And you're going to make some friends there. Everybody next to you is going to be locked into the bets they have going. You will as well. But every game will be front and center. And the seating in there, it's plush, it's beautiful. It's better than what you have in your living room. Whether you're all in on your favorite team or just love the thrill of big matchups in college football, it's the spot to feel every play, every score, every win. Grab a seat. You can catch games. You can place an order on their game day menu from Guy Fieri's, and you will get in on the action. It is game day done right. Whoever you're rooting for, watch the game in comfort and style at Caesars Sportsbook inside Horseshoe Tunica and enjoy full-service betting experience. In-game wagering, they have staff betting windows, they have 10 self-betting kiosks. You will always have a way to lock in the bet of your choice. It's the ultimate in college football viewing experiences. If you want to get into the games, get in on the action. You need to get to Caesar Sportsbook inside Horseshoe Tunica. See you on Saturdays. You must be 21 or older to gamble. Know when to stop before you start. And if you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Now we need to go ahead and rewind here on the Gabe Kuhn Show. We'll do that next. 92.9 FM, ESPN.